my opponent's already churning up, ready to say, we're going to go after Begich as a governor. You bet. Bring it on.
Senator Mark Begich launches his campaign following the primary election. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, August 20th. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Governor Parnell claims victory over the oil tax referendum.
I don't consider a 5% win in the end as close. I mean, we've got lots of elections. That's deemed a landslide.
That's tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. Check the status of your permanent fund dividend application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for contributing to a college savings plan and to add or change charitable contributions. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska.
Now that former DNR Commissioner Dan Sullivan has won the Republican primary, U.S. Senator Mark Begich knows who he'll face in November. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, Begich is staking out his positions with an emphasis on his record and abortion rights.
Begich faced no serious challenger in Tuesday's election, so he's been out of the campaign spotlight in recent weeks. He told supporters at a luncheon in Anchorage that Sullivan and the rest of the Republican field pulled to a conservative extreme in the primary debates.
They have gone so far right, you can't even describe what right is anymore.
Sullivan has said he wants abortion to be illegal, except following rape or incest, or to save the mother's life. Sullivan also says the Supreme Court made the right call in the Hobby Lobby case, allowing certain employers to refuse insurance coverage for contraceptive methods they object to. Begich told supporters he takes the opposite positions.
You all know me. I have been pro-choice from day one. It is the women's choice to make the choice about their health care. And we don't need government telling you what to do with your bodies, and we don't need Dan Sullivan to tell you what to do with your bodies.
Begich has been under attack for allegedly taking undue credit for achievements of the entire Alaska delegation, and Senator Lisa Murkowski demanded that he take down an ad saying they work well as a team. Begich, though, listed what he says are his successes, such as building the military presence in Alaska, fully funding tribal health care contracts, opening the Arctic to offshore oil drilling, and expanding health care options for Alaska veterans.
You know, I'm proud of these accomplishments. I know my opponents are already churning up, ready to say, we're going to go after Begich as a governor. You bet. Bring it on. Bring it on. I'll talk to you until you're blue in the face about everything I've done to make sure Alaska is a better place.
The candidates and independent political groups have already spent more than $18 million on the race. For the primary, that comes out to about $115 per voter. Dan Sullivan didn't talk to reporters on election night and had no public appearances the day after. His spokesman said Sullivan granted 2 print interviews but needed to rest his strained voice, which has been reduced to a whisper. In Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin.
A referendum to repeal Governor Sean Parnell's signature oil tax law is trailing by nearly 7,000 votes, and its opponents are now declaring victory. When the first returns came in, the referendum was up by exactly 5 votes. The vote yes, repeal the giveaway team marched into Anchorage's Election Central, cheering enthusiastically and believing momentum was on their side. But as the night wore on, the numbers began to turn against the ballot measure. By the time all precincts had reported this afternoon, the no's were beating the yeses, with 52% of the vote to 48%. At a press conference, Governor Parnell says he sees the results as decisive.
I don't consider a 5% win in the end as close. I mean, we've got lots of elections. That's deemed a landslide.
Parnell says the results should spur industry to invest more in oil and gas production in the state, a major argument used by the referendum's opposition. Meanwhile, supporters of the referendum charged that by capping the tax rate at 35%, the new regime gives too much of a break on oil production. They want to go back to a system where the tax rate on production went up along with the price per barrel. As of 4 o'clock this afternoon, the referendum sponsors still had not conceded. The Division of Elections still needs to count about 15,000 ballots, with potentially more coming in. TJ Presley is the campaign manager for Vote Yes, Repeal the Giveaway, and he doesn't think the race is a landslide for the no crowd. He's getting satisfaction from the race being such a tight one. He believes that if the referendum had been on the general election ballot along with a set of initiatives on marijuana, the Pebble Mine, and the minimum wage, it might have been more successful. Instead, it was on the primary ballot, which tends to draw more conservative voters, and it shared space with a high-profile Republican Senate contest.
It really was a perfect storm, and yet, in spite of all that, we still got 48-52.
The referendum was the most expensive race over a ballot measure in the state's history, with the oil industry putting in more than $10 million to defeat the measure. Referendum sponsors spent a fraction of that amount, with a little over $500,000 raised. APRN's Capital reporter Alexandra Gutierrez has been following the campaign. Hello, Alexandra.
Hi, Ellen.
Hey, is there any hope the referendum supporters can close the gap?
Well, with only about 15,000 ballots yet to be counted, you know, more could still come in with the absentees, it's a pretty high order for them to try to shrink it by any reasonable margin. While the campaign still hasn't conceded, most people I've talked to within it have kind of accepted that this is it for them.
What are the implications of the referendum vote for the governor's race in November?
Well, I'm sure that Governor Sean Parnell was pretty relieved this morning when we had 98% of precincts in and it looked like the referendum was failing with a comfortable margin. This has been his signature issue. Oil taxes have dominated the work the legislature has done for the past few years. So if voters had come out and voted yes, it would have been a blow to his campaign. As it stands, it means that The insurgents, independent candidate Bill Walker running with Craig Fleener, and Democrat Byron Mallott, who will now be running with Hollis French since he won his primary last night, they don't have as much they can't really point to the fact that, hey, voters spoke on your signature issue and they didn't like it. While it was a close race, it still went in the no vote's favor.
Well, looking at the legislative primaries on Tuesday, there are a few incumbents who won't be returning to Juneau. Tell us about those races.
Well, probably the most interesting one of these is the race for District 9. That is a district that covers part of the Mat-Su, but then stretches from Valdez to Delta Junction. And for the now three cycles, it's had incredibly close primaries. Representative Eric Feige, a Republican from Chickaloon, has been in office for two terms. And the first time he won, it was in a three-way race where all the votes were within about a couple of dozen votes of each other. And then last go-around, he ran against one of his opponents from this cycle, George Rauscher, and only won by 100 votes. So he's always been seen as vulnerable in the primary process. But this time he lost. He lost to Jim Culver, a former Mat-Su assemblyman who was heavily supported by labor unions. Culver got 38% of the vote. And then George Rauscher, who I just mentioned earlier, he came in second with 32%. Feige didn't clear 30%, so he's not going to be returning to Juneau next session. And since he was co-chair of the House Resources Committee, which is a very powerful committee in the legislature, that's going to have some implications for how the House Majority Caucus reorganizes. Then the other interesting race where an incumbent lost was out in North Pole. We had Tammy Wilson and Doug Isaacson, both two incumbents who had been put in the same district, being forced to face off against each other. You can't keep two of them, so Representative Tammy Wilson ended up coming out ahead with 55% of the vote. She is a furious campaigner. She knocked on over 2,000 doors, and going into the race, people were expecting that hard work to pay off for her.
Okay. Well, thank you, Alexandra.
Thank you, Ellen.
Alexandra Gutierrez is APRN's Juneau correspondent. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a frigid swim across Kachemak Bay.
The current brought the glacial water right to us, and it was extremely cold. So the last probably mile was pretty excruciating.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you've served in the military, the Alaska VA welcomes you home and thanks you for your service. We encourage you to enroll for VA health care benefits. Go to 1010ez.med.va.gov to apply online in less than 5 minutes, or print, fax, or mail the 2-page form to the VA. You do not need your DD-214 to apply. Call 257-3323 for questions. This message is sponsored by the VA.
According to the recently released Healthy Alaskans 2020, an assessment and strategic plan issued every decade, Alaskans aren't all that healthy. A 15-page overview of Alaskans' health status as of 2012 shows Alaskans are not doing as well as people in the U.S. overall in every category. KNBA's Jacqueline Estes reports.
Dr. Jay Butler, Senior Director of Community Health Services for the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, says Healthy Alaskans 2020 is different from earlier versions.
The process was unusual in that, as far as I know, this is the first time any kind of statewide health strategic planning process has been facilitated through a partnership between a state and a tribal health organization.
The report also differs from the 2010 version by cutting back from tracking hundreds of indicators to focus on just 25. At the top of that list is cancer, Alaska's leading cause of death, followed by heart disease. They're the top killers across the nation as well, but with heart disease number one in the U.S. overall. Alaska then veers away from the rest of the country, according to Community Health Improvement Manager Lisa Aquino with the Alaska Division of Public Health. She says unintentional injury is the third leading cause of death here. It's fifth for the U.S. overall.
Usually this happens in young people, on any kind of unintentional injury. So that could be related to transportation, like car crashes, and could be related to, you know, ATV or snowmobile crashes, boating incidents and drowning, unintentional poisonings. It includes a lot of things, but that's an area where Alaska is consistently higher than the U.S.
The report shows disparities exist among different races, age groups, areas of the state, and with varying income and educational levels. Suicide rates are 67% higher than the U.S. overall. Butler says the assessment also looked at new health indicators.
Obesity, diabetes is a concern. High rates of suicide are a concern. Health-related effects of tobacco and alcohol use are of concern. But there were other things that came up that ended up among the 25 priorities that may be surprising, including a broader range of behavioral health issues.
The assessment shows the percentage of Alaskans without health insurance has risen since 2000 from 17% to 19%. The national rate of uninsured is 13%. Butler says the report also looks at other social conditions that contribute to disease.
Many poor health outcomes are associated with low levels of education and low levels of income and poverty. And then also access to quality care.
Aquino says 40% of health outcomes are linked to the decisions we make every day. What we have for breakfast, whether we take the elevator or the stairs, use seat belts, and make sure our kids get their vaccinations.
There are so many different factors in our lives that impact our health. This report reflects our state as a whole, but I think it really informs each of us individually about the kinds of health decisions we can make.
Healthy Alaskans 2020, which includes the health assessment, a scorecard, and targets for the 25 indicators, is available on the State of Alaska's Health and Social Services Division of Public Health website. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Most food Alaskans consume comes from outside, but there are quite a few producers who grow and sell locally. Last week, KTNA's Philip Manning visited one farm that has been operating in the Upper Susitna Valley for the past 30 years.
In Alaska, the vast majority of the food we eat isn't grown here. Patrick Likely of the Alaska Food Policy Council says the proportion of food grown in-state is very small.
5% of food that's consumed in Alaska is actually coming from Alaska.
While most of the food does come from outside, there are still a fair few local growers. In the Upper Valley, one such producer is Birch Creek Ranch. Birch Creek has been run by the Kingsbury family for the last 3 decades. Alan Kingsbury says that the family first acquired the land as an agricultural parcel from the state in 1981. Early on, the only products coming out of the property were a result of the clearing that the state requires on ag parcels.
We sold firewood and saw logs and lumber and that sort of thing while we were getting the fields cleared and ready for production.
As more land was cleared, Alan and Leilani Kingsbury began to grow crops. Their first sales began in the mid-80s.
We were growing some things and trying a lot of things. Everything from sheep and goats to barley and sorghum, wheat and
rye,
forage turnips and potatoes. We grew seed potatoes for a while.
As time went on, the Kingsburys moved toward greenhouse production of flowers and away from things like potatoes and animals. They also have a large berry patch where people can pay by the pound to come and pick currants and service berries. Alan Kingsbury says that one issue facing farmers today as compared to the 1980s is a decreased level of state support.
The state was much more gung-ho agriculture back in earlier days in our time frame when Jay Hammond was governor.
Leilani Kingsbury agrees and says one of the biggest issues that has faced Alaskan farmers for decades is the need for infrastructure, such as
plants, places to store, cool, chill, clean, process, and equipment and supplies and services. People that can service them, repair them. We're still all lacking very much.
Now, much of the growing at Birch Creek Ranch is done by Alan and Leilani's son, Brian. Currently, the farm grows about 4 acres of vegetables, including a number of high tunnel greenhouses. One way Brian sells his vegetables to locals is through a community-supported agriculture, or CSA, program. That lets individuals buy a share of the farm, which entitles them to a portion of the crops at harvest time. Brian also sells to local restaurants, but he says the majority of his revenue comes from old-fashioned farm stands.
About a third of my business has been with the CSA, and then another, about half of it now is retail markets, and then the rest of it is the restaurants.
The restaurant contracts are growing, however. This year, Brian says that he's begun selling to the Talkeetna Alaskan Lodge, easily the biggest lodging facility in the area. In addition, he started selling at farm stands outside of the valley.
I saw that I needed to take things to Anchorage, and I started with a farm stand at the Alaska Native Medical Center campus. It's a big move for me.
Brian says the Anchorage trips take an entire day in addition to the extra picking, but that it does allow him to break into a new market. One local venue that makes extensive use of Brian Kingsbury's produce is the Flying Squirrel Bakery and Cafe. His wife, Anita Golton, is the majority owner and manager of the cafe. She says that the businesses complement each other well.
We just kind of do it all together, and it's always made a lot of sense to take farm products from there and to be able to have other possibilities for places to use those products seems like a really valuable thing.
Anita Golton says that the Flying Squirrel has been recognized by the Alaska Department of Agriculture's Restaurant Rewards Program, which reimburses part of the cost of buying local ingredients in order to offset what are usually higher prices. Despite using over 600 pounds of rhubarb and various other ingredients from Birch Creek Ranch, as well as other Alaska growers, Anita says the supply simply isn't enough to keep up with production most of the time. As a result of that supply gap, a small portion of her total product is made with primarily Alaskan ingredients.
I feel like we try to do as much as we can to integrate it in everything, and it's probably a lot more in the middle toward the end of summer, but probably not more than 1%. And the main reason for that is there are so many ingredients that just aren't available.
The entire family agrees that visitors and locals alike enjoy the fact that they can have locally grown produce available during the growing season. Brian says he's currently looking to consolidate on crops and markets that have proven successful in order to make Birch Creek Ranch a success for another generation. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doy Unlimited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. And by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine.
Alaska Native voters in the Yukon-Kuskokwim region of Western Alaska give the UPIC language primary ballot translations mixed reviews. All 8 of the UPIC voters that KYUK talked with said they needed help understanding what they were voting on. KYUK's Charles Enoch has more from the Kuskokwim Hub community of Bethel.
Elder Jacob Nelson is originally from the coastal village of Gwigilngok. He moved to Bethel in the 1970s and he speaks mostly Yupik and very little English. He says leading up to Alaska's primary election, he heard some information on the radio in his language about an oil tax referendum.
I've only ever heard about the ballot initiative on the radio, not from anywhere else.
Alaska's primary ballot asked voters to weigh in on whether to repeal oil tax changes made by the state legislature last year, among other things. This primary was held on the heels of a trial where attorneys with the Native American Rights Fund argued the state of Alaska was not doing enough to help Yupik voters understand the issues in their language. The State Division of Elections argued they are doing enough. Critics say the translations are full of jargon and legalese that are difficult, if not impossible, for mainly Yupik-speaking voters to make sense of. Like many elders in the area, Nelson says he couldn't understand the Yupik ballot because it's written in a modern style that he's not used to. He had someone working at the polls explain the issues to him in spoken Yupik and marked an English ballot. He says he's glad there is some effort, but there could be more.
This will be good for the people if people could understand what they are voting for and if we understand it the way we speak.
It's estimated there are around 10,000 Yupik-speaking voters in Alaska. It's the second most spoken language in the state behind English, and also the second most spoken Native American language in the country behind Navajo. A decision on the lawsuit against the state of Alaska regarding language translations is expected soon. In Bethel, I'm Charles Enoch.
The 2 totem poles that stood for 36 years in Juneau's old Indian village have been hauled off. A work crew with a 12-ton boom truck pulled the delicate poles and hauled them to a warehouse on Tuesday. They had deteriorated badly over the years, but were taken away more or less intact. Ricardo Worrell is the president and CEO of the Tlingit-Haida Regional Housing Authority, which owns the Gaza Hit building where the totem poles stood.
There's a lot of discussion as to what would be the best and most appropriate solution and what we're going to do with them. We even talked about letting them lie in state here in the village.
Worrell says fear of vandalism and concerns pedestrians wouldn't properly respect them have cooled that idea.
So for now, we're going to bring them to the Housing Authority warehouse, let them dry out inside the warehouse, and then we'll decide what we're going to do with it from there.
Brian Wallace was a teenager when he watched the late Edward Kuntz Sr. carve the poles. Tuesday, Wallace happened to be passing by and stopped to watch.
It's mixed emotions, you know, see something like this, and I don't know how well it could be restored or if it's going to go back to the spirit of the forest.
Worrell says parts may be salvaged for indoor display. Meanwhile, a pair of Haida carving brothers that the Alaska Heritage Institute commissioned have completed the new totem poles and nearly finished the new screen that will replace the warehoused ones. Worrell says the target date for raising the new poles is September 29th. Early this past Sunday morning, three Homer women joined the short list of athletes to successfully swim across Kachemak Bay. KBBI's Quentin Chandler spoke to one of the swimmers about her experience.
Former Henderson State University swimmer and current swim coach for the Kachemak Swim Club, Dana Jaworski, says she's considered swimming the bay since she first moved to Alaska nearly 10 years ago. Then last winter, her what-ifs took a strong turn toward becoming reality when she and her friend Jan decided to go for it.
I walked up to Jan one day at swim practice and said, "Hey, I have something I want to ask you about." And she said, "Me too. You want to swim across the Kachemak Bay?" And I said, "That's what I was going to ask you." And it was meant to be.
Jan Rumble is also a coach with the club. She and Dana were joined by a teacher from Anchor Point, Lila Lee Little, and they started training for the big day on the 1st of June.
And really, the distance as far as open water swims go, it's not that far. I mean, Diana Nyad swam 72 hours straight, you know, from Cuba to Florida. This is nothing like that.
Dana says their swim was about 4.5 miles, and each of the women have done that before, so the only things that worried them about getting into the water were possible run-ins with jellyfish, fishing boats, and, of course, the cold.
Just a mile and a half off the end of the spit, the current brought the glacial water right to us, and it was extremely cold, and it just got colder. And so the last probably mile was pretty excruciating.
The swimmers had friends following them on boats to avoid falling into the path of another vessel, and they didn't see a single jellyfish, just some seals, salmon, and a humpback whale. All in all, Jan says the swim was a huge success.
The weather was perfect, and our support crew just did great. Other than the cold, that was the only thing we encountered, and it was a beautiful swim and a beautiful day.
The trio first planned to start the swim on Saturday morning, but because of poor weather, decided to wait until Sunday. They have bumped the number of people to swim the bay up to at least 10. Claudia Rose of San Diego made the last swim back in August of 2013. In Homer, I'm Quentin Chandler.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Charles Enoch in Bethel, Jeremy Shea in Juneau, and Quentin Chandler in Homer. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez and Liz Ruskin reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ExxonMobil Alaska, where more than 1,000 Alaskan men and women are working on the Point Thompson Project, proving energy lives here. And by Craig Taylor Equipment Company, an authorized John Deere dealer. The Anchorage location just behind the Ship Creek salmon fishing offers a wide range of John Deere compact tractors. CraigTaylorEquipment.com. Where can you see more than 1,000 entertainers, from Alaska native dancers to dinosaurs? The Alaska State Fair. This year, everyone attending the fair can enjoy music free with fair admission, like Riders in the Sky, Young Dubliners, Redhead Express, Savannah Jack, Home Free, and Kentucky Lineman. Learn more at thealaskastatefair.org. Music, fair food, and good time fun. It's what the Alaska State Fair is all about. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Fair.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.